Hey everybody, welcome to our weekly 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes. Of course, we were off last week as we were all celebrating Purim. I hope everyone had a beautiful Purim. I know I did, Baruch Hashem. Now we are on our countdown to Pesach. Believe it or not, Shabbos HaGadol is in 2 weeks, and Pesach is 3 weeks from tomorrow night. Pretty wild to think about. Not that I've done a single thing for it, nor will I ever do a single thing for it, but Baruch Hashem. So here we go. 3 ideas in 30 minutes. I'm going to get in trouble for the last comment. 3 ideas in 30 minutes. I want to thank our sponsor, anonymously in memory of Teddy Kellen, Shimon Tuvia, Ben, Dov, Yehuda, Leib, Chaim. If anyone wants to sponsor a future episode of 3 ideas in 30 minutes, they're welcome to contact the show office. I also want to dedicate today's learning for Refuah Shleima for my cousin, Rafal Arna Cohen Ben Rivka, who is in need of a Refuah Shleima. So again, I want to thank our anonymous sponsor, and our learning should be both Liuli Nishmaso for Teddy Kellen and for Refuah Shleima for Rafal Arna Cohen Ben Rivka. Here we go, 3 ideas in 30 minutes. As I tell you each and every week, I struggle. This is such a juicy parsha. How could you limit yourself to 3 ideas? And even when you have the 3 ideas, what order do you do them in? So here we go. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to start. I'm going to do my favorite idea, the middle idea. That'll be my teaser. How about that? Idea number one comes from the story of the Chet Egel. And the story of the Chet Egel is somewhat strange. And I want to focus on one particular narrative. And that narrative that I want to focus on, I just have to pull up the psukim here. Give me 1 second. The narrative that I want to focus on is, here we go, right at, as Moshe Rabbeinu is coming down the mountain. Moshe Rabbeinu is coming down the mountain. Vayishma Yoshua Skola Am Bireo. Yoshua hears a boisterous sound in coming from the people. Vayomer el Moshe kol hamachaneh kol milchama b'manachaneh. So he says to Moshe, he's again like Moshe's coming down the mountain. Yoshua is halfway and the people are obviously at the bottom. So Yoshua says to Moshe, I think there's a war going on in camp. Vayomer, and Moshe says back to him, ein kol anos gvura. Ve'ein kol anos chalusha. That is not the sound of triumph. It's not the sound of defeat. In other words, there isn't a war going on. Kol anos anochi shomea. Rather, it is the sound of song that I hear. So it's a very strange interchange, if you really think about it, between Moshe and Yoshua, right? On the one hand, Yoshua hears it first. Moshe doesn't hear it. Like, what did Yoshua hear that Moshe was unable to hear? Second of all, what is Moshe correcting Yoshua about? In other words, was Moshe more in tune to the sounds of cries than Yoshua is? What is going on here? Why did one hear it before the other? And why did Moshe understand the sound any more so than Yoshua was able to understand the sound? So the Ramban over there says that what Moshe was doing was actually giving Musar to Yoshua. Right? Yoshua thought it was the sound of war. Moshe comes along and says, no, 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 no. My dear friend, you're hearing a different sound. And what he's doing is giving him Musar. Says the Ramban, right? She'amar lo Moshe, misha asid linhog srara al Yisrael. Someone who in the future is going to play a leadership role over the Jewish people. Eino mavchin bein kol l'kol. He can't understand the voices of crying. I'll give you the best analogy that I can think of. And some of you might appreciate this more than others. Right? Every now and then, my kids will cry. So to me, all kids crying is the same, right? Oftentimes, I don't even hear it, as my wife reminds me quite frequently. But my wife knows the difference between cries, right? She knows a cry that's a cry because her brother just hit her. She knows the cry of a small fall. She knows a serious cry when it means like drop whatever you're doing and come running, right? My wife is in tune to the difference between cries in a way that I myself am not even in tune for. And so we'll be sitting at the dinner table and we'll hear a cry, and sometimes she'll know to ignore it. Other times we'll hear a cry and she will fly out of her seat and be in the other room, right? You understand the difference between different cries. That's what makes her such an incredible person, and me not so much, right? Says Moshe to Yoshua, if you're going to be a leader of the people, you got to know the difference between the cries. You got to know the difference between a cry because I just fell and tore my pants and a cry because I'm really hurt and need my parent there right now. Says Moshe to Yoshua, that's lesson number one of leadership, is know the difference between the difference of the cries. But I want to share with you today a different interpretation. And this comes from a Sefer Chomer Ledrush, which is written by Rav Naftali Kohler. And he writes the following, and I want to read it for you here in Hebrew, and obviously I will translate it with you. He says, Ava be'emes chidush nifla kan. He says, I'm going to teach you an amazing idea. And it's predicated on the notion that Moshe is unable to hear what Yoshua hears. Yoshua hears the sound at first. Moshe does not hear the sound at first. Why doesn't Moshe hear that sound? Says Rav Naftali Kohler in his Sefer Chomer LeDrush, Ki Moshe Rabbeinu haya yored minahar veluchos ha'idus beyado. Think about where Moshe just was. He was on a mountain. He was in seclusion. He was learning Torah. V'chol mi sheyesh biyado luchos ha'idus ve'atorah. And anyone who's fully engrossed in Torah learning, eino shomea kolot acherim. They are not going to hear other voices. In other words, how did Yehoshua hear while Moshe did not? Says the Chomer LeDrush, because someone who's truly immersed in Torah learning is deaf to the world around them. So long as Moshe's holding on to those luchos, he could hear nothing else. Now, there are two ways of understanding this magnificent idea of the Chomer LeDrush. One of it's very practical, which is that Torah is a demanding pursuit and it requires our full focus and our full attention. But I think if you take it a little step further, it means that when Moshe was there on the mountain, that when Moshe was fully engrossed in Talmudic study, what it really meant is that he had trained himself to not be distracted. That in order to fully grasp the magnitude of Torah learning, he understood and he trained himself to be able to focus on one thing at a time. That focus, like so many things in our lives, is like a muscle. The more you train that muscle, the more you will be able to benefit from it. And the more you allow yourself to be scatterbrained and easily prone to distraction and multitasking, so the less you're going to be able to focus. There was a time, not long ago, where we thought that multitasking was a good thing. That we thought being able to do a million things at once was actually a virtue. And now we're coming to understand that it's the exact opposite. And so says the Chomer LeDrush, the message of Moshe not hearing the sound is that all of us have to make time for ourselves like Moshe on that mountain, to be able to carve out time for ourselves where we are unable to be distracted. In Kelm, the famous Musar school, they spoke about a time during the day where all they did was focus. They called it a Hasmada Seder. Hasmada means like, I'm diligent in my studies right now. And basically what that meant was, is that while I was engrossed in that area of study, that no matter what, I did not allow myself to be distracted. And even if it meant that I was coming across a line in the Gemara or a word in a book that I didn't understand the meaning of, I put it off to the side. I didn't get up. I didn't look it up at that moment in time. I'll come back to it later, because no matter what, I wasn't going to allow myself to be distracted. I was going to focus on one thing and one thing at a time. Obviously, it goes without saying that this is a lost art in our generation, that as we have a multitude of notifications on our devices and text messages coming in and WhatsApps coming in, again, all of this is enormous brachas, and it's enabled us to connect in ways that we couldn't have dreamed of 20 years ago. We also have to understand that it comes with a negative component to it at all, as well, a challenging component to it as well, and that is that we've lost the ability to focus. We've lost the ability to hone in on one idea or one thing at a time, and I think that is a tragic lost art. I think it will water down not only our study of Torah, it will water down our lives, it will water down our relationships, and so the more we are able to focus, the more we are able to train our minds 2 minutes at a time, 30 seconds at a time, 10 seconds at a time, 10 minutes at a time, to not be distracted, I believe the better off we will be. The better off we will be cognitively, the better off we will be in our relationships, and the better off we will be in our Torah study. I think part of the challenge that the younger generation has when it comes to Torah study is exactly this idea that Gemara is hard and learning is hard. And if you can't focus, it's going to be that much harder. And so idea number one is, why wasn't Moshe able to hear that sound? It's because he had so trained himself to be able to block out the world around him. He had so trained himself not to allow himself to be distracted that it was Yoshua who heard it first, not Moshe. Moshe only hears it after Yoshua points it out to him. And again, I think that's an idea. It's a wonderful idea for our Shabbos table. certainly if you have children or grandchildren, to discuss that idea with them, right? Are we a distracted generation? How do we combat the fact that we are a distracted generation, right? Do we turn our phones off during davening? I could promise you that if your phone is on during davening, even if it's in your pocket, you will be distracted by it. I can promise you that if you're those people in our shul, that my phone's off, but every time I get a text message, it goes bing, you're not only distracting yourself, you're distracting the entire shul around you. You simply cannot have a meaningful conversation with Hashem if the binging and the buzzing are going off every millisecond. It's impossible. And I got news for you. If you're sitting at the Shabbos table, we got bigger problems. If you're sitting at the dinner table and every 5 seconds there's buzzing and binging going on, you simply will not focus on your children. And your children will not focus on you. And you are training them in improper ways for how to engage in human interaction, where you are focused on the person that is in front of you and not the myriad of people that are sending you senseless text messages at that very moment. I think it is an art that we need to recalibrate desperately as we, again, continue down the spiraling road of technology. And again, Chas Shalom, I'm not saying technology is evil. I'm just saying that there are challenging components of it that we need to do a very good job, a much better job of controlling. That is idea number one. Beautiful idea by the Chomer Lidrash. Idea number two, and I'm going to give you a warning, and it's rule number one of what you shouldn't do as an educator, which is warn your audience, but I'm going to warn my audience because I like you guys very much. It's a little bit more of an involved idea than we normally do, but if you bear with me throughout the idea, it is gorgeous. It's not just good. It is gorgeous, and I promise you, it is worth it. So even if you need to buckle up a little bit to hang on for the ride, I promise you it's worth it. Money back guaranteed. Here you go. New idea. First time I ever saw it this year. Sharing it with you right here and right now. Idea number two comes from a very peculiar Gemara. And the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, Daf, Kuf, Dalet, Amud Aleph, tells us about the Luchos, the tablets that Moshe Rabbeinu brings down from Har Sinai, Amar of Chizda, Mem v'Samach Shebaluchos, b'neis hayu omdim, that the Mem and the Samach were standing as a miracle. They were miraculously, in other words, they weren't connected to anything else. And then Amar of Chizda, then Rav Chizda makes a separate statement, Kasav Shebaluchos, that the writing in the tablets, right, Nikra mibifnim v'nikra b'mechutz, that it was read on the inside from one end of the tablets, and it was read on the outside, and those from the other side of the tablets, in reverse order. In other words, you could look at it from each side, and you'd be able to see the writing, right? But on one side, I'd see it in one way, and on the other side, I would see it in the reverse order. Now, the Gemara is going to cite words that appear elsewhere in Tanakh as proofs of this. And what are the proofs of Rav Chizda? Nevuv buban, right? Nun bet va bet. If you read it backwards, is buban, bet, vav, bet, nun. Or, second example, rahav and bahar, resh, hey, bet, bet, hey, resh. And the last example is saru, samich, resh, vav, in varas, vav, resh, samich. What in the world is Rav Chizda doing? This is the question of Rashi. This is the question of Tosos. Tosos says it more succinctly. Tosos looks at Rav Chizda's proofs, and he says, Tema, de'amai nakat lehu, kevan de'lav havo beluchos. Why does Rav Chizda bring examples? Nevuv, buban, rahav, bahar, saru, varas. It has nothing to do with the luchos. The Rashi says this also in a little bit different of a way, but asks the exact same question. What is Rav Chizda trying to prove here? By showing that there are words that can be inverted elsewhere in Tanakh, oh, and that's a proof that in the Luchos, that's what happened. How is that proof? If anything, you should have brought me proof from the actual words of the Luchos. That is the Gemara, that is the comment of Tosos and Rashi, both of whom are puzzled by what Rav Chizda is trying to do in the Gemara. I want to share with you a magnificent idea. A magnificent idea from the Mei HaShiloach, from the Ishbitzer Rebbe. Says the Ishbitzer Rebbe something amazing, and I'm going to tell you the answer, and then we're going to go back and we are going to prove it. Says the Ishbitzer Rebbe what Rav Chizda was trying to do was to show us something quite profound. And what he was trying to show us is that all three of these pairings that appear in Tanakh is showing us something about self-improvement. It's showing us something about the Torah. It's showing us about the transformative power of the Torah to achieve a 180-degree turnaround and complete makeover. That if you engross yourself in Torah, you're able to take bad midos and to turn them into good midos. So let's go word by word and prove it to you. The first example that Rav Chisda gave was nevuv and buvan. What does the word nevuv mean? So if you look where it's used in Sefer Shmos, again, people who want to look this up, this is chapter 27, verse 8 in Shmos, where the pasuk says about the copper mizbeach that appears in the Mishkan, it says that it was filled, right, with a wood. And what does it say? Nevuv luchot ta'aseoto. That it should make it of nevuv luchot. Rashi says, what does the word nevuv mean? Rashi over there says it means hallowed. The word nevuv, says Rashi, means hallowed. That it's a precedent for the word describing something that is hollow. Says the Ishbitz Rebbe, when applied to a human being, it means that someone who is hallowed of Torah, someone who is an ignorant in his Torah learning. What does buvan mean? So he says, buvan comes from the word bina, which means someone who is involved in Torah. And so example number one of Rav Chisda is that the Torah has the capacity to transform our minds from something that is vacuum, something that is void of any Torah knowledge, into someone that's intelligent and containing wisdom. That's nevuvu buvan. Example number two was Rahav and Bahar. What does Rahav mean? So again, he proves, the Ishbitz Rebbe does, that Rahav is describing someone who is, right, a Baal Taiva, someone who is overly possessed with temporal pleasures in the world, in the here and now. Okay, what does Bahar mean? So Bahar means the exact opposite. Bahar means someone that is on a mountain. In other words, someone who is transcendent, someone who is above all of this. And so says the Ishbitz Rebbe, that Torah has the power to transform our minds that are plagued with taiva, with desire and immorality, into something that is noble and lofty and otherworldly, something that is up on a mountain. That is, Rahav and Bahar. And lastly, we have Saru and Varas. Saru, if you look in Sefer Malachim, Perek Chaf, chapter 20, verse 43, it says, Vayelech Melech Yisrael al Beiso, Sar Vizeaf, that the king left, and he was Sar Vizeaf, says Rashi, says Mitzudas. David over there, what does the word Sar mean? It means he's angry. He's angry. Vizeaf means he's disgruntled. Sar means to be angry. What does Varas mean? So Varas, if you look in the Pasuk Yechezkel, says, let me find it, right? Talking about the Korban Mincha, it says you have to mix within it Laros Es Hasolas, which means to moisten up the flour. What does all this mean, says the Ishbitz Rebbe? Right, Torah once again has the capacity to take someone who's hardened with anger and to regain a certain gentleness, to moisten them up a little bit. Okay? What is the point of all of this? Right? If I've lost you up until this point, I'll get you right back now. Again, Rav Chisda said that the Torah can be read on either side of the Luchos, and it's going to be inverted depending on whether you look on one side or on the other side. And Rav Chisda, as a proof, brought these strange words from elsewhere in Tanakh: Nevuv, Buvan, Rahav, Bahar, Saru, Varas. What is all this talking about? Says the Ishbitz are so obvious that what Rav Chisda was trying to do was to convey to us a message. And it's a message about the transformative nature of Torah. That if we engross ourselves in Torah study, then we have the capacity to go through a 180-degree turnaround, a makeover of ourselves, that we can take our bad midos, our bad characteristics, and we can actually transform them into positive midos, into positive characteristics. And so, like, what was the first example? Nevuv and buvan. That if you are a nevuv, that if you are hollowed out, if you don't have Torah study, then through Torah study you can become buvan, you can have bina, you could have good understanding of Torah. You can become intelligent and have a wisdom and an insight that was previously unachievable to you. Words number two was Rahav and Bahar. You can turn yourself from someone who's overwhelmed with desire and temporal pleasures in this world to someone who is Bahar, someone who's up on a mountain, someone who's lofty in noble pursuits, someone who isn't just involved in the here and now of this world, but someone who is involved in otherworldly pursuits, namely Torah and mitzvos. And lastly, Saru and Varas. Sar means that you're angry. Someone who has negative midos. Someone who is overcome with the hardness of anger. That's not a word, I know that. But he become varas. He could become soft and gentle and pleasant to be around. Let us engross ourselves in Torah study. Because the more that we do that, and the more that we learn, and the more we involve ourselves in Chumash, in Rashi, in Musar, in Chassidus, in Gemara, the more we are going to improve ourselves. Torah has the capacity to create a 180-degree transformation and makeover of us. That is the second beautiful, magnificent idea of the Ishbitzer Rebbe in his Me'ah Shiloach, Parshas Ki Tisa. I'm happy to send anyone the primary source if they are interested. Idea number three comes from the Luchos again. And that is when Moshe throws the Luchos, says the Pasuk, that Moshe comes down. Where am I? I lost my Pasuk. Vay Gevalt. Right? Vayihi kasher karav ela machane vayara sa'igel umecholos. That Moshe Rabbeinu sees all the dancing. And he sees the Egel again dancing over here. They weren't dancing the Hora. I just saw an article that Charles Barkley, a very famous basketball player, just described how he has to get in shape to dance the Hora at his daughter's wedding. He has to get in shape to dance the Hora. We, I guess, take it for granted that we are in shape to dance. Charles Barkley needs to get in shape. They weren't dancing the Hora back then, right? When the Torah describes that they were dancing, it was in promiscuous and licentious terminology, okay? So, that would have been a good Dvar Torah, by the way. Okay, for next year, right? Vayichar af, maybe I'll give you a bonus today. We'll see. Vayichar af Moshe. Moshe gets very angry. Vayashlech miyadav es haluchos. He throws the luchos. Vayishaber osam tachas ahar, and they shatter. Now, if I take a poll with you right now, what does it mean that Moshe threw the luchos? Most of us, I would venture to say, 99% of us would describe the same scene, which is that Moshe gets angry and he throws it, right? The description I gave earlier this week was that, like, you know, when in school the teacher got angry at you when we were growing up, now they'd be fired. Now there'd be a lawsuit. But when I was growing up, teachers got angry. They were allowed to get angry. And what'd they do when they got angry? They used to take the chalk and, like, throw it across the room and it would shatter. And it was to create, like, a whole... Now you knew the teacher was serious. So that's what Moshe did. That's how I always envisioned it. Moshe got angry. In his fit of rage, he took it and he threw it right at every... No. Says the Rashbam, something doesn't add up. Says the Rashbam that really what happened was, Vayashlich mi'adav means that Moshe Rabbeinu suddenly felt the full weight of the luchos and they were going to fall because he couldn't hold it anymore. It was too heavy for him. But what happens if something is going to fall? Where does it fall? If something gets too heavy and it falls, where does it fall? It falls on your toe. I learned this the hard way at Pesach last year. I was carrying something very heavy and it fell. And it fell on my toe. And it was enormously painful. And thank God I didn't have to walk to shul because we were in lockdown. But it was very hard to walk. So I know Moshe's conundrum. So says the Rashbam in a beautiful comment there, Kesheras Egel, that when Moshe Rabbeinu saw the Egel, Tashash Kocho, he suddenly became weak. Vilohaya bo koach lahashlicham rachok. He no longer had the strength. Don't forget, the luchos were big stones. He no longer had the strength to hold them, right? So he's going to drop them. So instead of dropping it on his toes, right? So lahashlicham rachok mimenu ktsas shelo yazik es raglav binaflam. He pushes it forward a little bit, simply so that it does not shatter his precious little toes. That is the Rashbam. So says the Rashbam, Moshe didn't throw this out of anger. Rather, he sees the Chet Eigel. He suddenly becomes weak. And instead of having it fall on his toes, he pushes it forward a little bit so it doesn't shatter his toes. Now, If that's the case, it first of all totally transforms the story. Moshe is not angry here. Moshe is depleted here. Moshe is weakened here. And that begs the million-dollar question. Why is Moshe depleted here? All of a sudden, right? In other words, the weight of the luchos has not changed. They were heavy a minute ago, they're heavy now. All of a sudden, Moshe Rabbeinu gets weak. So pshat is that he got disgruntled, right? That his mindset changed. That if you're like, you know, if you're running a marathon and you're going to crush this and you're depleted, you're at the 20-mile marker, you've hit that proverbial wall. So you could still go if you have the right mindset. If your mindset tells you, come on, I can do this, I can get the other 6.2 miles, you're going to do it. And the second your mindset changes, the second you say to yourself, I don't know if I could do it, I don't know if it's worth it, right? The second that self-doubt creeps into your mind, all of a sudden you start feeling weak and you start feeling achy and you start feeling painful. It is 100% mindset at that moment in time. And so that's pshat in the Rashbam. Pshat in the Rashbam is that Moshe all of a sudden his mindset changed. That previously he's like, come on, we can do this, I got the luchos. And all of a sudden he sees what the Jewish people did and he's like, I don't got these luchos. They're really heavy. And so he has to drop them. But I want to share a different vort on that Rashbam. And that is as follows. That up until that point, what were the luchos? The luchos were not physical. The luchos were spiritual. Right? While Moshe was carrying a physical object, he knew that the physicality of the luchos were really a means to an end. The end was Torah. The end was the spirituality of the Torah. The minute he sees Chet Egel, Moshe Rabbeinu realizes that the Jewish people had supplanted materialism with spirituality, or spirituality with materialism. That they had made a physical object to serve as an intermediary between them and Hashem. That they had made the physical object the end, not the means. And all of a sudden, these physical luchos stopped being spiritual. They started being strictly physical. And Moshe Rabbeinu can't hold them at all anymore. If that's the case, then it's a beautiful idea that comes out of this Rashbam. It's an important reminder that physical objects in Judaism are only a means to an end. The end, of course, is our relationship with Hashem. The end, of course, is our ability to connect to Hashem in this world, right? The Mishkan, the Mikdash, the Luchos, all of these physical representations are only what we call in Gemara terms, a Hechi Timsa. They are a means to the end, but the end is my relationship with Hashem. And if I take away the Luchos, or if I take away the Mishkan, or if I take away the Mikdash, while that's tragic, at the end of the day, I could still have my relationship with Hashem. Because all I need for a relationship with Hashem is myself. I can talk to Hashem right now. I don't need a Mikdash or a Mishkan or a Luchos to be able to connect to Hashem. And so the moment Moshe Rabbeinu sees that the Jewish people had placed their emphasis on the physical representation and not on Hashem himself, these luchos became physical. And that's why he wasn't able to hold them anymore. As opposed to the luchos carrying themselves, now Moshe was carrying them and he had to drop them. Where else do we see this? I'll give you another story in the Gemara. It's the story of the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Yurches, where Rav Chananya ben Trajon is cloaking himself in a Torah scroll and his students see him that he's being burned at the stake. And they say, Rebbe, what do you see? And what does he say? He say, Osios Porchos, right? I see that while the object of the Torah scroll is being burned, but the letters of the Torah scroll are flying up to Shamayim. Right? What is Rav Chananya ben Trajon representing to us there? What is he communicating to us there? That you can burn our Torah scrolls. That throughout our history, you can burn our Sfarim, and you can burn down our Beis HaMikdash, and you can burn our Torahs, but you know what you can never destroy? You can never destroy the words of the Torah, the letters of the Torah, because those are spiritual. Our connection to Hashem supersedes any one physical object. And so you can burn our Torah scrolls, but you can't burn our Torah. You can knock down our Beis HaMikdash, but you can't knock down our connection with Hashem. You can create an Egel, but that's not going to represent the truth of what our relationship with Hashem is about. Because ultimately what that relationship with Hashem is about is us. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes in his Halachic Man that Judaism is by definition democratic. It means that I don't require any intermediary between me and God, that the only thing I need to do is to open my mouth anytime, any place, and I can have that rendezvous with my Creator. That is the greatness of Judaism. Now, obviously, other religions have bastardized this throughout our history, right? Christianity took this notion of physicality and they created an intermediary between Christians and God. That you need someone physical to serve as that intermediary, right? We, of course, wholeheartedly reject that, right? That when the Kohen Gadol was no longer there, we said, okay, there's no Kohen Gadol to achieve atonement on our behalf. That's fine. Ashreichem Yisrael. Mi mitaher eschem. Who's going to give you that purification? Avichem Shabashamayim. None other than our Father in Heaven. That if we don't have a Kohen Gadol, and if we don't have the Korbanos, and we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, that's okay. All you need is to approach Hashem with authenticity, in a genuine way, and you'll be able to have that relationship with Hashem. Christians obviously took this notion of, right, the physicality, and they said, no, you need something physical. We Jews come along and say, no, you don't. That if we don't have a Mikdash, if we don't have a Mishkan, if we don't have a Luchos, that's okay. Because we will always be able to have that connection with our Creator, again, at any time and at any place. And so let us, let's review our three ideas. I know we said a lot this morning. We went a few minutes over, that's okay. But we said a lot this morning. Idea number one was the idea from when Moshe was coming down the mountain and Yoshua hears this cry and Moshe does not hear the cry. And we asked why. So we explained from the Chomer Ledrush that the reason is because Moshe Rabbeinu had trained himself to focus. That he understood that in order to fully grasp the world of Torah, you needed to understand how to block out distraction and train yourself to focus. And that's what you and I have to do. We need a Hasmada Seder in our lives. We need to train our minds with the ability to what they call nowadays deep think or deep focus. And I promise you, it will pay you back tenfold. Set aside a minute a day, 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day to train your mind to focus. It will help your ability to learn. It will help your ability to interact with other human beings. And it will give you more menuchas hanefesh. It will give you more peace of mind. That was idea number two. One. Idea number two came from the Me'ah Shiloach, the Yishbitzer Rebbe, this beautiful idea. What was Rav Chisda trying to tell us when he said that the luchos are nikra mibifnim, v'nikra b'bechutz, that they are red on one side and red on the inverse on the other side? Rashi and Tosfos all point out that these examples that Rav Chisda gave, Nevuv, Buvan, Rahav, Bahar, Saru, Varas, what are those strange random examples throughout Tanakh? So says the Me'ah Shiloach, where Rav Chisda was trying to tell us, is that each one of them represents a midah, each one of them represents a characteristic, and the other one is the inverse of it. And the message is that Torah has the capacity to transform us, to give us a makeover, to change who we are. And so whether it's from Nevuv to Buvan, someone who is void of Torah knowledge to someone who's intelligent, whether it was Rahav to Behar, someone who is pursuing his temporal pleasures, to someone who was Behar, someone who was lofty and noble, or whether it was Asar to Varas, someone who was angry, hardened with anger, to someone who is soft and gentle, that, says the Yishbitz Rebbe, is what the Torah has the capacity to do. And the last idea is, what does it mean, Vayashleich mi'adav? So we thought that it meant that Moshe was throwing it in anger. The Rashbam says, no, all of a sudden Moshe realizes just how heavy the luchos are. And so instead of dropping them on his toes, he pushes it forward as they're falling. And we wondered, all of a sudden now Moshe Rabbeinu realizes how heavy the luchos are. The luchos were heavy before that. So said the Meforshim, no, that up until that point, the luchos were spiritual. They were ruchnius in nature. And so it wasn't that Moshe was carrying them. They were carrying themselves. They weren't governed by the laws of physicality. All of a sudden, Moshe looks at the Chet HaEgel and he sees that the Jewish people have succumbed to focusing too much on materialism and physicality. And these luchos stop being spiritual and they start being physical. And all of a sudden, Moshe Rabbeinu can't hold on to them anymore. And the message of that, says the Mefarshim, is that we always have to remember that our physical representations in this world are a means to an end. They are never, chas v'shalom, the end unto themselves. And that absent of any of those physical representations of God in this world, whether it's the Mishkan or the Mikdash or whether it's the Luchos, it is irrelevant to us. The only thing you and I need to have a relationship with Hashem is our heart. That I can talk to Hashem now. I can talk to Hashem in a forest. I can talk to Hashem at any time and at any place. That is the mistake that other religions have made. And again, I can give you so many makoros for this. The Rav and Halachic man elsewhere says that one of the catastrophes of Jewish history is our over-focus on the synagogue, over-focus on relating and interacting with God in shul. Says the Rav, no, you can have a conversation with God anywhere and at any time. It's not relegated to one place or one time. That is the message that we derived from this interpretation of the Rashbam. So with that, I wish everyone a beautiful Shabbos. Again, I want to thank our anonymous sponsors for sponsoring in memory of Teddy Kellen, Shimon Tuvia Ben, Dov Yehuda Leib Chaim. Again, it should be Rafua Shleima for my cousin, Rafal Aaron HaKohen Ben Rivka, to be Rafua Shleima for him. And I want to wish everyone a beautiful, meaningful, and inspirational